Ming? Senlin nodded, relieved that he had not yet been discovered.
The sun is doing its work. Your Ogier is nearly cured.
He rubbed at his nose and sniffed daintily several times.
It has been exhausting for me, but I have drafted some excellent impressions.
Excellent impressions!
Pound echoed, and slapped the decree he'd been reading against the chest of an unprepared agent. The agent fumbled to catch the papers before they spilled.
It occurred to me that perhaps an interview would make a nice frame for your article. Bald facts are so dull. We should sit down and discuss my thoughts on the art world.
Yes, indeed. Of course,
Senlin said eagerly. The minutes were slipping by. What if Maria wasn't conveniently placed? What if she was locked in a room across the baths or sitting in a tub in the fountain? It might take him hours to find her, even if Ogier knew exactly where she was staying. He'd have to sneak about town like a thief. As a thief, in fact. To Senlin's relief, the commissioner was already losing interest. The headmaster was preparing a bow when the bare-chested swarthy wretch, the newly made Hod, leapt through the agents and grabbed Senlin by the coat. He pulled Senlin into a fierce embrace and dug his fingers into his back. Senlin's revulsion was automatic. He turned his head and fought to bring his arms up between them, but the Hod only gripped him more tightly.
"My friend, it is me!"
Senlin turned back to re-examine the man's wide face, threaded with sweat and blood from where the unforgiving razor had scored his scalp and cheeks. Without his imperial beard or his iron mane, Taru seemed now like a ghost cut from its shell. Only his slate eyes and warm baritone were recognizable. Senlin quickly turned back to the commissioner.
"Commissioner Pound, there must be some mistake. This is Taru. He was in your home 2 nights ago.
"I'm just as surprised as you, Mr. Senlin. There is no mistake. Ledgers do not lie. He has not paid his bills in more than a month, and yet has gone on living like a sheik."
Senlin thought of all those dinners and bottles his friend had bought for the two of them. He had been stubbornly generous.
"So, he is a little tardy. I'm sure he will pay his debts now."
Senlin gripped his friend's hard shoulders.
"This is no time to be shy with your wallet. Out with it."
"I cannot,"
Taru said. All his humour, his acid wit, was gone. Senlin looked into Taru's eyes and saw a man who had passed beyond humiliation, passed through despair and fear. Some primitive kernel had burst open inside him. Taru was now livid with rage. Abruptly, Taru roared over Senlin's head at the goggling crowd.
"I betrayed myself and my friends. I grew fat and tired."
Taru gripped the sides of his gut, a softened swell of abandoned muscle.
"I drank and danced and soaked myself silly. But I was never free. I was only distracted. I now appear to be what I have been for years. A slave."
The crowd blanched when Taru, in a gesture of pique, smeared the blood from his scalp down over his eyes.
"We have society, but we are alone. We have light, but we have no sun. The tower sucks our lives and gives us only a little diversion and a little death. Do not accept a little death. Demand a great, booming demise."
As each phrase burst with more hatred and bile than the last, the men and women who had come to stare, to watch with voyeuristic pleasure, found themselves becoming the focus of attention. The commissioner and his agents watched the audience for any wince of sympathy or revolt. The onlookers stood motionless as startled rabbits. They blinked in the shadow of a hawk. Amid this horrible tension, Senlin vaguely registered Taru's hand passing into his coat pocket. Then Taru shoved him so violently he was sent reeling backward against the cowering mob.
"And here, you only care about your paintings and your book. Academic, anemic, you are as cowardly as a clam. Your death will go off like a fart."
Senlin was pained by his friend's abrupt betrayal, and his shock registered baldly on his face. But in the very next moment he understood Taru's motive. It wasn't to hurt him. It was to protect him. He was making it apparent that they were not really friends, and certainly not co-conspirators. Nevertheless, Senlin was shocked by Taru's seditious outburst. He had always shied away from political statements, had seemed always afraid that they might be overheard. It was only now, when there was nothing left for him to lose, that Taru was free to speak his mind, and it had been, Senlin thought, a fine speech. The commissioner flicked his hand, and his agents leapt on Taru. They swung their black lacquered clubs at his legs, and his knees buckled. A second rain of blows to his back and shoulders made him collapse entirely. Taru refused to cry out, even as he was driven into a ball on the ground. Senlin wanted to leap into the frenzy of batons and scrabble down to his friend and split the abuse. But that would make an end of everything. Taru's sacrifice would be worthless, and Maria would be lost forever. He would have to be the coward once again, and once again leave a friend behind. The commissioner casually resumed their conversation.
"Come by my home this evening at 8, Mr. Senlin."
Pound's voice sounded like a wasp in a can.
"Bring a sharp pencil or two. I will add some flamboyance to your facts."
He turned from Senlin, concluding the exchange, and pointed at Taru, where he lay panting raggedly, his eyes already swelling shut. Without a hint of inflection, he said,
"Put that in the wall."
In the distance, bells rang the half hour. Senlin pushed outward with his shoulder. No one tried to stomp on his toes now. They parted before him like water about a stone. Nor did they gawk at him, but only looked down as if they were afraid. And why shouldn't they be afraid? Ruin was contagious. If Taru, who was so well-liked, could be ruined so summarily, undefended by anyone, what hope did anyone have? Maria. What hope was there for her? Senlin found the artist sitting on the bench by the shore, as promised, the sleeves of his paint-spattered smock tied up around his elbows. Ogier sat with his hands in his lap, a serene, unfocused expression on his face. He would seem, to the casual observers, a lamentable sort, a poor hunchback outcast. But Senlin knew better. There was nothing about Ogier that deserved pity. Ogier was clever and commanding. He had marched Senlin around easily enough. When Ogier saw Senlin, he did not stir much, but only nodded at the opposite arm of the bench. Senlin sat down and, without looking at the artist, spoke to the air and the uninterested migrations of bathers. "They have Taru. They've turned him into a hod." Turning his head finally toward the painter, Senlin felt his face flush with anger. "I hope the painting is worth it to you. It was not worth it to me." He felt his composure slipping. He wanted very badly to blame the artist, to hold him accountable, and to punish him. "I have only an hour before the alarm is raised, because of your incompetent copy." Senlin watched the plot unravel on the stage of Ogier's face. The painter's expression bloomed and wilted and bloomed again, as disbelief and despair ran through him. It was frightening to watch Ogier's confidence collapse, and fascinating to watch him struggle to rebuild it, first with the smoothing of his brow, and then the untangling of his mouth. His composure regained, the painter dispensed with his earlier discretion, and turned to face Senlin.
"Then we haven't time for this. The painting is still around the bottle?"
"Yes," Senlin said, sliding his satchel down the length of the bench. Ogier snatched it quickly, a little alarmed by Senlin's cavalier shuttling of his precious cargo.
"Wait here,"
Ogier said, and left Senlin on the bench. The artist took the satchel to one of the green-painted bathhouses, hardly larger than an outhouse, paid a dozy attendant 2 pence for the key, and then disappeared inside. Several minutes later, Senlin was on the verge of rising and beating the flimsy door of the changing stall in when the artist emerged. Ogier gestured Senlin to his feet.
"We must hurry."
"Tell me about Maria," he said, with planted feet.
"As we go, there's little time before they will close the ports to trap you here. That will be the commissioner's first move, to tighten the noose.
Auger opened a small paper accordion and consulted the printed grid. He scanned the port schedule for a moment before announcing,
"A ferry leaves at the top of the hour from Northport. We'll be pressed to get there in time."
"I haven't any money."
"I will get you aboard."
"Is Maria there?" "At Northport." "Tell me where she is, or I promise you I will—"
His voice quavered, and he gulped. He found he was clenching his fists and bringing them up. Heat ran up his spine like a fuse. The artist gave Senlin a disarmingly fragile smile. His expression was sympathetic, genuine, and devoid of the arrogance that had seemed permanently chiselled there. It was as if Ogier had, all in a moment, pulled off a hood he'd worn since the first time Senlin had set eyes on him.
"I am sorry I had to treat you with such suspicion, but I had to be sure."
Bewildered, Senlin dropped his hands, and Ogier pressed on.
"This place is full of spies and traitors. I had to be sure you were Maria's husband. You have given me all the proof I need. You would risk anything for her. I will tell you all I know, but we have to leave for Northport this instant. We must hurry, without seeming to."
Chapter 11. The truth, when finally told, will often sound strange, while a lie is so often familiar. Every Man's Guide to the Tower of Babel. With their heads drawn so close that they looked like conjoined twins, Ogier and Senlin ploughed away toward Northport. They skirted the agents who prowled among the bathers, scrabbling about the perfectly curved shoreline. They didn't dare run. Brass music brayed from an unseen bandstand, the piccolo rising shrilly over the joyless band. The afternoon sun no longer dazzled, but seemed rather like a scaly disease that scabbed the tourists and blighted the pastel hotels. The fountain vented steam like a factory stack. A girl selling oranges from her apron, still years from womanhood, was trying to evade a cotton-headed, lecherous gentleman who tried to pinch her hips and stroke her hair. The girl dropped the corners of her apron, letting the oranges fall and bounce and roll underfoot as she made a nimble escape. Senlin thought of his own students for the first time in weeks. The memory seemed like a fable, an ancient and unsophisticated ideal. He used to occasionally dream of bringing his class to the Tower of Babel on a grand field trip. Now he couldn't imagine anything more specious. Through it all, Ogier spoke as if he was reciting a well-rehearsed tale, as if Maria's story had occupied his heart and mind for weeks. And so it had been. Maria had surprised Ogier with her interest in his work, how he mixed his paints and organized his palette, how he developed his novel, blobby style. She listened keenly to his explanations. At the conclusion of their first session, Ogier counted out her payment while she dressed. A dazed expression softened her face. One of the many landscapes that leaned against the parapet caught her attention. She approached it and retreated from it, as if trying to bring it into focus.
"It's like the mottling of a bird, isn't it?" she said. "It seems one hue from a distance, but up close there are many colours."
Buttoning the cuffs of her yellowing blouse, she turned her attention to the canvas on Ogier's easel. She recognised herself immediately. Her reddish hair was, here and there, flecked with shades of green. Her red lips were daubed with blue, and the skin of her bare stomach and breasts was a pastiche of pinks, browns, and purples. She had never seen herself outside of a mirror, and she found this view quite different.
"It's not like seeing yourself in a glass at all. Is that what I look like?" she asked, with more wonder than doubt. "To my eye," Ogier said. "Often the most difficult part of painting someone is convincing them that they look like their portrait."
It was an unusual conversation. Ogier didn't usually burden his models with his philosophy. The young women who sat for him had neither the interest nor the capacity to make it worth his effort. They came to him for pocket money and nothing more. But this woman radiated an intelligence he rarely saw in the anaesthetized crowds of the baths. So he went on.
"Flattery in portraiture guarantees a long but miserable career.
Maria saw the logic in this, and nodded as she buttoned the waist of her skirt.
"But if you paint us as we wish to appear, we would be unrecognizable. What good is a portrait that doesn't match the subject?"
"Exactly right," Ogier said. "One has to tell lies that don't hide the truth."
By the time she left, Ogier was a little charmed by her curiosity and wit. Again, he found himself wondering why such a woman would spend an afternoon modelling to make a modest sum. He could only imagine that she was in some trouble. He wondered if she even realized how much trouble she was in. When she returned the next morning, he wasn't entirely surprised. She was less sheepish in her offer to model for him, suggesting that she could be engaged for several days in a row if he liked. For anyone else, Ogier would have demurred and felt insulted at the suggestion that his inspiration worked on a model schedule. But the prospect of a longer study, a more complete work, with this astute and exotic woman, was enticing. So he agreed. He asked her to pose much as she had the day before, though he fussed more with getting the sheet to drape just so across the back of the chaise longue. He wanted the work to be larger, to capture her entire figure, but he was hesitant to broach the subject of further disrobing. A moment later, as if she had read his mind, she emerged from behind the curtain, fully undressed, settling on the sofa with the natural grace of a falling leaf. His white and yellow orchids seemed to fan the air about her hair, shoulder, and bosom. He was enthralled. As he worked, they began a natural dialogue, not like the rapid lisping of gossips or the conversational tug-of-war between young wits, but rather they talked like two old men playing draughts, with ponderous silences, unspoken consensus, and shrugged replies. Over the course of the session, Ogier listened as she slowly unspooled her history. He learned of her recent marriage and how her honeymoon had been quickly derailed. She described her first hours alone in the market, the realization that she was without a ticket or a means of acquiring one, and her quick reasoning that she should ascend to the third level of the tower, to the baths, where, after all, she and her husband had planned to spend the majority of their days. She had passed through the beer-slush streets and waterworks of the basement. She scavenged a moth-eaten cloak from the gate of a rubbish wagon and wrapped herself in it. Her red sun helmet was entirely too conspicuous, so she kept it tucked under her arm. She spoke to no one in the basement, and whenever she was approached, she would cough as violently as one dying of consumption. Even notorious-looking men would squint at her and give her a wide berth. Ogier found her resourcefulness quite entertaining. She had passed through the parlour's quagmire in less than a day by affecting the most boring, charmless version of Mrs. Mayfair she could muster. She pretended to fall asleep at the height of their stilted professions of love, and then snorted when she pretended to come awake. She laughed during their arguments, and acted as if she had choked on a biscuit when Mr. Mayfair swore, for the second time, his undying love. Her performance was uniformly panned by the other players, who, in exasperation, quit the play. 2 days after she'd lost her husband in the market crowd, she entered the baths, fearful that she had kept him waiting. She had no way of knowing that, at that moment, Senlin was just entering the basement, blundering through the crowds, his progress slowed first by denial, then by shock. Very quickly it became apparent that finding her husband among the touring masses and the scores of hotels was a nearly impossible task. Her initial inquiries were met with either derision or extortion. One hotel purveyor went so far as to propose a corporeal form of payment that Maria might offer in exchange for his assistance. Having spent many hours in pubs among men who drowned their discretion, Maria knew exactly how to reply to such a proposal, and paid the man on both shins with one boot. As the sun set on her first day in the baths, realizing that she had to be frugal with the money she had left, Maria asked a young woman selling soaps where she lived. She was directed to a women's boarding house that was run by a mouse-faced old woman named Ms. Curd. The crone's eyes were dark and sharp as pencil lead. Maria installed herself in a closet of a room in the attic of Ms. Curd's house, stowed her money under the mildewed mattress of her coffin-sized bed, and slept in her clothes, too exhausted to dream. The next day she took a little pocket money and her red pith helmet and went in search of some professional assistance. She was certain that there had to exist somewhere in the baths an institution that helped the wayward and the lost. Miss Curd informed her that there was nothing so organized as a mission, but she suggested that Maria might ask one Mr. Horace Fosser, a retired customs agent known for his social connections, for help. Miss Curd offered to arrange a brunch meeting at the Crepe House. Maria thanked her profusely, and the beady-eyed woman responded with an arthritic curtsy. Mr. Fosser, it turned out, was an exceedingly well-mannered man, who was free of vice, except for snuff, which he took only with apologies, excusing himself after each inevitable sneeze. He had been handsome once, probably. He was still relatively thin, with the slicked, inky hair of a young man, but his heavy jowls and receded chin betrayed his age. Maria was hesitant to confide in him, having learned caution from her previous encounters in the baths, but Mr. Fosser had an uncanny ability of deducing from the vaguest of cues the exact nature of her troubles. It was as if her whole story was written out in her clothes, her subtle shifts, and the timbre of her voice. He guessed her history, and she only had to confirm his suppositions, which she did with some amazement. Was it some sort of trick, she wanted to know, this ability to guess her history?
"No trick, my dear, just a special attunement," Mr. Fosser said demurely.
He insisted that he be allowed to use his contacts to help locate her husband. He was willing to do this for the very modest retainer of a shekel a day, all of which he would return if he failed to produce her husband in a fortnight. Then he paid for their lunch and departed on his mission, even before Maria was entirely committed to it. But then, what else could she do but accept? She returned to Miss Curd's boarding-house to budget her remaining funds with this new expense in mind, only to find that her cache of money had vanished. She flipped her dank mattress 3 times before she could believe it. She had been robbed. Confronting Miss Curd proved fruitless. Curd proclaimed that all the girls in the house were the worst sort of immoral trollops. Thievery was the least of their sordid habits. Curd assumed Maria would have had more sense than to leave her valuables in a room without locks.
"I run a boarding-house, not a bank, missy," she said. "Rent's due in the morning."
In a daze, Maria wandered out into the daily furore of the baths and the mob of shoppers and peddlers that stood as thick as clover. Oh, what she would have given for a patch of grass or tree shade amid the infinitely circling sidewalk! She found a bench by the shore, posed herself politely, and then retreated into thoughts that seethed with self-reproach. How could she have been so stupid? She had ascended the tower with such clever nimbleness, and now everything turned on a single mistake. Her only hope was to be quickly reunited with her husband, but the only way to do that was to pay Mr. Fosser his daily allowance to plumb his contacts. It was at that moment that an artist with paint in his hair thanked her for being such a willing subject for his work. Which brought them, Maria concluded, to their present arrangement. She sat, and Ogier paid her just enough to keep Mr. Fosser on call and her head on a cot.
"I don't suppose you've heard of Mr. Fosser?" Maria asked. "Perhaps overheard his name at a party or a pub?"
"Madam, I am persona non grata in the baths. I hardly know anyone any more."
"Being unknown has its advantages."
Maria shrugged her shoulder an inch, which seemed an exaggerated gesture under the microscope of the painter's eye.
"Never say that to a painter," Ogier quipped.
At the end of their second session, Maria announced that Mr. Fosser was arranging interviews for later that week. Ogier was a little disturbed to find that Maria didn't know who she was meeting. All she could tell him was that Mr. Fosser had told her they were a secret society of altruists, as yet untainted by Babel's immoral influence, who were willing to help the deserving. These were men of principle. They believed in 2 economies, one material and one eternal, whose currency was goodwill and self-sacrifice. They called themselves the Coterie of Talents, and they had, according to Mr. Fosser, galleons of gold at their disposal.
I've been thrown a lifeline, Maria said, and the relief she felt deepened the corners of her mouth into the dimples of a smile. Do you know how I prepared for the possibility of our separation? I dyed my hat red. If I'm ever going to find Tom, I'm going to need help. I can't just strut around the cafes hoping to be spotted. I need help.
Unwilling to cast a shadow on her optimism, Ogier smiled and kept his reservations to himself. For the first time in years, he wished he had a wider society of friends and resources. The coterie of talents. He didn't like the sound of that. The next day, she arrived in a new dress, a pale blue strapless gown that flattered her figure and accentuated her slender neck. The dress was free of the usual foufarore, the frosts of sequins and explosions of feathers that seemed popular of late. It was a classic and stately dress, free of any ornament except for the staging of her décolletage. It was a dangerous dress. Trying his best to appear undisturbed by her transformation, Ogier asked how the search for her husband was progressing. Maria confided that Mr. Fosser's methods were a little circuitous. The previous evening, after their session, she'd again met Mr. Fosser at the crepe house, and he had insisted that they postpone dinner until she had a chance to change into her proper evening attire.
"My dear, I've been busy sowing the seeds of your virtue with my friends," Mr. Fosser said, taking a pinch of snuff and turning his head to delicately expel it on the sidewalk. He apologized, and then repeated the process twice more. When he finally regained himself, his eyes were red from sneezing.
"I have written dozens of letters on your behest, and already there are some in the coterie, I believe, who have developed an interest in you."
He leaned over the table, his jowls pinched in around his earnestly puckered mouth.
"One or two of them may be prepared to throw all of their resources behind the search for your husband. Believe me, these are the most principled of men, but they are also practical. They won't endorse someone who appears—"
He glanced mournfully at her tattered blouse.
"Destitute. They have learned that poverty naturally makes a person dishonest. So they are suspicious. You must appear hopeless, but not helpless, if that makes sense. In short, we must polish you."
Maria confessed that all of her luggage had been stolen in the market, and that she was at present short on resources. Paying Ms. Kerr for room and board and retaining Fosser's services was the limit of her finances. Fosser immediately, almost eagerly, proposed that he buy her a dress.
"I'm sure that your husband will be able to compensate me for any out-of-pocket expenses, and I know a brilliant seamstress who owes me a favour."
When Maria argued that she would be uncomfortable being too greatly in his debt, he insisted.
"Think of it this way. You must at least give me a chance to succeed. I have already invested so much in this effort. If I fail to find your husband, you may keep or return the dress as you like."
He smiled, his jowls rising a little wolfishly. Though unhappy with the arrangement, she could not argue with his logic. If she appeared as a pauper, she likely would be treated as one. So she spent the remainder of the evening being fitted for a new dress, as directed by Fosser, at a rather posh boutique. While he painted, Ogier listened to her account with increasing alarm. Though he couldn't be sure what Fosser's true motives were, he doubted very much the existence of a coterie of wealthy philanthropists. No matter how these nobles preferred to dress their charity, or what currency they preferred to deal in, there was only one economy in the tower, and it was not the eternal sort.
"Tonight I am to be introduced to some of Mr. Fosser's friends," Maria said, redressing at the conclusion of the session.
Ogier frowned as he squeezed the paint from his brushes and stirred them in baths of turpentine. His scowling made Maria worry that he was unhappy with the work or with her modelling. Ogier reassured her.
"No, it's coming along fine," he said, gesturing at the canvas and the emerging, almost spectral figure.
He was pleased with the proportions and the tone of the work, though he was still dissatisfied with her expression, which seemed conflicted. Her mouth smiled with a natural grace, while her eyes appeared to glare intensely.
It will be a great work, I'm sure. I hope.
No, I'm worried about you.
Are you sure this Mr. Fosser has your interests at heart?
Most likely he does not, Maria admitted. He seems greedy and vain and a little shallow-minded. I'm sure he'll squeeze every last cent from Tom, but it is only money.
The rich say the same thing, but they never mean it, Ogier said, and paid her for her day's work.
Chapter 12. One shouldn't feel compelled to attend every ball, or accept every proposal, or finish every glass that is raised. The sun is sometimes brighter when watched from the shadows. Sometimes, to enjoy a scene fully, we must first retreat a little way. Every Man's Guide to the Tower of Babel.
Senlin's heart felt like the air bubble of a level. It slid up and down his throat, searching for a centre that had apparently vanished. It was Ogier's description of the pastel blue of her dress that did it, that made him recall the queer, half-blacked-out book he had saved from destruction weeks ago. The Wifemonger's Confession, or whatever it had been called, had recounted a theory of colour that had, at the time, seemed impossibly esoteric. Now he was not so sure. The marble faces of hotels seethed with the embers of afternoon light. Senlin clung to Ogier's arm, and they barreled on under the shadows of marquees of dance halls and dinner clubs, the shadows appearing moth-chewed under the mirror lamps turning above, like disembodied eyes.
The next few days continued in much the same way. Maria arrived in the morning and departed mid-afternoon. During their occasional breaks, Ogier made tea and set out pastries that she would eat while he smoked cigarettes. They looked out from their rooftop fort, guarded by orchids, time-worn tapestries, and exquisite fumes, and felt serene. Maria was a natural model. She was aware of her figure, but not enamoured of it. She was at ease without being limp. The resulting pose was more beautiful than anything the younger maids had ever achieved. And always, while he sat mixing his paint and labouring over her obscure expression, dropping in and wiping off a dozen failed strokes, she regaled him with reports of her evenings. Every evening she would accompany Mr. Fosser to a different private party. Fosser selected their ports of call and, when she inquired, refused to explain how he chose them. These soirées, as he called them, were mostly held in lavish rented drawing-rooms and parlours, which were invariably wallpapered with silk and gold leaf or silver foil. The soirées were more staid than a gala, but less formal than a dinner. A few dozen well-groomed men and primly arrayed women, apparently all strangers, would be in attendance. There was always a gregarious, tireless host, who did not so much mingle as stir the room. And there was little for her to do but sit around and nod and smile and glance wistfully at the piano. There was always a piano, and without fail it was abused by a parade of unshy amateurs and tone-deaf flirts. It was torture. If any one of them sat down at the upright piano in the Blue Tattoo public house, they would have been booed into a weeping pulp. Before each evening began, Mr. Fosser ritualistically repeated thorough directions of how she must conduct herself. She had to wait to be approached by the other guests. She wasn't to mention her grave circumstance or make any reference to her tragedy unless asked directly. Fosser would broach the subject of her need when appropriate. Maria only had to be charming and to appear deserving of attention and assistance.
"They are, my dear, very discreet people. The talents are extremely generous, but they think charity crass. They prefer patronage."
He emphasized the word with a wag of his jowls. Maria was a little offended by Fosser's lack of faith in her social polish, but being generally ignorant of this society, she imagined there were probably a few points of etiquette with which she was unacquainted.
"And please, please, my dear, do not converse with any of the other young ladies. Their families are very protective and will be nervous at how an exotically grown young woman like yourself might influence their sisters and daughters.
I know it is ridiculous, but it will save me from having to smooth many feathers if you will just keep to yourself. Exotically grown. He made her sound like a white stoat, or a nugget of amber, or a desert lemon tree. Maria couldn't imagine a more dreary and counterproductive way to conduct herself at a party. But she dutifully kept his counsel. At least, she did for several nights. The first few evenings, she'd felt a little confused by the gatherings. She smiled and nodded herself dizzy, and was generally ignored by everyone. She spent most of the evening eating finger sandwiches and sipping sherry or champagne. She entertained herself by privately inventing stories for the coiffed men dressed in all manner of suits, some courtly, some military, and some comically roguish. She'd never seen so many frilled collars. Every now and then, Mr. Fosser would appear with a captain or courtesan in tow, and Maria, understanding that these were members of the coterie of talents, would grace them with what she believed was sparkling banter. Yet, each time, her new acquaintances quickly found a reason to excuse themselves, leaving her alone with Fosser, whose jowls stood on either side of his frown like grim bookends. It was hard not to be offended. She could only conclude she was doing something wrong, though she couldn't imagine what. After several evenings of feeling like the appendix of the party, she asked the exasperated Mr. Horace Fosser what she should do differently. In the corner of a conservatory, while her piano was haltingly plunked at by a young man who possessed more humour than talent, Fosser replied in a whisper, "I'm having trouble getting any interest in your circumstance, my dear. It can't be helped, I suppose. You just naturally blend in." "What did you expect? You won't even let me strike up a conversation. It is hardly my fault your parties are so dreadful. If I smile any more, my cheeks will shatter," Maria said, in a whisper that ran hoarse. "Is that really the limit of your charm? I thought you were more ingenious than that," Fosser replied sourly, taking a pinch of snuff. He did not excuse himself when he sneezed. She began to worry that he would soon tire of trifling with her predicament and move on to other affairs, other charities. She doubted she could afford a better retainer, and did not doubt she would have to return the dress, which seemed her passport to these affairs.
"Let me make a direct appeal, Mr. Fosser. Perhaps a forthright request will be met with more—"
"Out of the question. If I'm caught with a begging woman on my elbow, I'll be ruined for 100 years. You don't know who these men are. Believe me, they aren't interested in pitiable creatures, in panhandlers and lepers. They are interested in souls that may yet be redeemed." "No. Obviously, I've made a mistake."
A round of tepid applause interrupted them as the amateurs playing faltered to a full stop.
"I will make an excuse for us, and we will leave," he said stoically.
He didn't give her time to argue before turning away. Maria described to Ogier in some detail the sudden gall she felt. She knew she had just been summarily dismissed by her champion, ignoble as he surely was, and would be soon left begging. Her decorum had its limits, and in truth, her pride had been pricked at the suggestion that she was too drab a personality to catch anyone's attention. She decided that if she were to be cast from the aristocratic bosom, she would at least make a scene of her exit. No one in the room took any notice of her smoothing her skirts under her as she lowered herself onto the piano bench, or her momentary petrification at the prospect of playing publicly after weeks of not practicing and with no sheet music to guide her. The only song that came to mind was an old sailor's ballad, a romantic lament that was popular at the Blue Tattoo. It was, she was sure, horribly suited to the refined tastes of her audience, but with little choice and a new impish indifference, she dove into her performance with such force and volume that a gentleman who had been leaning on the piano leapt into his drink as if he had been burned. Her voice rang over her fierce playing like a bell in a storm. She abandoned her emotions entirely to the tragic lyrics that described the drowning of a young fisherman and his despondent widow's suicide. She played through the gasps and the smattering of booze. She closed her eyes and sang herself to the brink, sang herself home to the cottage she shared with Tom, dear Tom, sang until his sincere, unsmiling face appeared before her, and her heart broke.
Exhausted, she concluded with a drum of bass notes that fell upon a silenced crowd. When she opened her eyes, a man with a close-cropped blonde beard sat on the bench beside her, studying her profile closely.
"You play like a deer runs, with terrified grace."
Before she could reply, Fosser was at her elbow, though he seemed more aware of the man at her side than her.
"An unusual performance, madam," he said.
"Oh, I was trying so hard to blend in,"
she replied, enjoying Fosser's uncomfortable squirming. Fosser was about to offer a rejoinder when she turned her back to him and began a closer inspection of the man at her hip. He was richly dressed in a grey wool suit, and his face was handsome, though his cheeks still carried a little of their youthful fullness. The beard seemed a means of compensation.
"And you, sir, did you find my playing unusual?"
"You meant it to be unusual. You are proud of your strangeness," he said, with an intelligent smile, though he seemed a little overly impressed with himself.
"It is better to be pleased by one's own distastefulness than to please another man's tastes," she said, eliciting an unguarded laugh from her new acquaintance.
"Marvellous! Mr. Fosser, you must introduce me to this charming hedonist."
She spent the remainder of the evening conversing with the bearded young aristocrat, under the watchful eye of Mr. Fosser. She was careful not to directly mention her bad fortune or her lost husband, but still dropped discreet hints that she was not without care or need. For his part, he seemed sympathetic to her cause, vague though it was, saying that he was always willing to help a friend. After they had taken their leave from the party, Fosser expressed his enthusiasm for the man who had occupied himself with her.
"He is enormously important, a veritable prince, and he seems very keen on you. I think he is willing to help."
Maria took this as some comfort, though she was still bothered by what seemed a Byzantine process. Why were they all behaving like coquettes? The man had been evasive about his own background, keeping even his name a secret. Surely local customs couldn't require the omission of one's own name.
"What is his name?"
"Be patient, my dear. He is famous, and famously private, though I'm sure he will be more open with you in the very near future."
All this Maria confided in Ogier the next morning, while she sat for him. And the morning after that, which would prove to be the last time Ogier ever saw her, she returned again with more stories about the mysterious aristocrat who she called the Count.
"I call him that because it bothers him, and I don't see why I should be easy on such a smug young man."
She had attended another party, a more exclusive one, and the Count had renewed his fascination with her, devoting most of his time to trading quips with her, with teasing her, with elaborating on the virtues of one sherry vintage over another. The remainder of the attendees seemed annoyed by her monopoly. The Count, oblivious to the scowls of the other young ladies, insisted that she play another song for them, insisted that she take a turn on the veranda with him, and finally insisted that she confide in him her greatest wish. Overcome with relief to have at last arrived at the point of all their flirtations, Maria said,
"I have lost my husband, and I need your help if I'm ever going to find him."
The Count clasped her hands in his own finely gloved hands, and immediately agreed.
"I will find your husband."
"Oh, that is wonderful, wonderful. I was beginning to think—"
She trailed off to stop herself from gushing. Their hands, his held over hers like oyster shells about a pearl, leapt joyfully. To Maria's great delight, the Count promised to produce her husband the following evening.
"Mr. Ogier," Maria said that final day in his company, "I will be reunited with Tom this evening, if the Count has half the influence he pretends to."
She again dressed in her pretty powder-blue dress, came around Ogier's easel to observe the fruit of a week's labour. Ogier pronounced it finished, though he still felt he needed to tinker with the orchid leaves that periscoped over her pale shoulder. She examined herself only briefly, before bursting into pealing laughter.
Understandably distraught, Auger cringed before her, as if he had been slapped.
No, no, it is beautiful, a masterpiece. I was only thinking what Tom will say when I show him how I've spent the interim of our honeymoon. And I will show him, I must.
She laughed again.
Please, let me bring him by tomorrow.
Auger looked nervous. The eventuality of showing a married man his undressed wife hadn't occurred to him.
I hope he has your sense of humour.
Absolutely not, but he is the most reasonable man alive. He will accept it as a fact. A strange and complex fact, but a fact nonetheless. He will understand it was this exercise that helped me survive until we were rejoined.
Then I'll look forward to the introduction,
Auger said, rallying his confidence. Maria pulled the painter from his chair and embraced him with sisterly vigour. A contented smile pinked her cheeks.
You have saved me. I will never forget it. And it is a wonderful painting. I wish I could see all the world so. You have such a romantic eye.
When she did not return the next morning, Auger took it as a good sign. Perhaps she had been reunited with her recently betrothed, and in the natural course of the morning, had thought better about exposing her husband, and herself, to the exact means of her survival. He could hardly blame her. Still, Auger couldn't help feeling a little disappointed. She had been such a liberating, encouraging presence. She had been good for him, though, as he examined his painting of her figure, he had to admit the effort was flawed. His infatuation with her character had coloured his recreation of her. He had captured the ideal, but not the woman. This struck him as poetic. She had sat without pretense, and he, without meaning to, had made her appear vain. Auger was deliberating whether he should undertake a revision from memory, a risky prospect, to say the least, when a young bearded man interrupted his meditation by bursting onto the rooftop. He was dressed in an unusual riding outfit, complete with stiff collar and puckered breeches. A red leather belt held the long holster of a pistol with a gold-plated grip. He was closely followed by two others, less richly dressed, each with squared shoulders and sabres swinging at their hips. By Maria's descriptions of him, Auger recognized the young man as her mysterious count. They barged into his terrace apartment as if invited. Auger did not think he should tell them they were not.
"You are Auger," the count said, without a note of question in his voice. "I have come for the painting you recently completed." "Ah, here it is," he said, and positioned himself before the portrait Auger had been recently critiquing.
The paint still gleamed.
"I'll be honest. I expected much worse. This is absolutely an adequate likeness, Mr. Auger. Congratulations. I will pay you 10 minas for it, twice what it's worth, surely."
Baffled by the count's appearance in his home, Auger didn't immediately grasp the implication of his presence.
"Why are you here?"
"Well, when Maria told me how you'd taken advantage of her destitution, my first instinct was to have you killed."
His hand dropped to the gold butt of his gun, and for an electrified moment, Auger believed he would be shot where he stood.
"Preying on young women to satisfy some carnal urge is really quite loathsome, Mr. Auger."
The count moved his hand from his pistol to open his collar a little. He leaned into the painting, his back to the painter, whose eyes darted toward the two men blocking his escape.
"But then, a man loathes most what he reviles in himself."
Now he turned toward Auger with a lecherous sneer, and everything became clear to him.
"It's no use fighting who we are."
"You haven't found her husband at all," Auger said.
"I have found him," the count replied, taking a step back and bowing for cute effect. "I am he, all but sworn."
Then, returning to the painting, the count looked to the bottom corner where Auger's signature stood in bright black letters. The count pressed his gloved thumb over the letters, smudging them beyond reading.
"I will let you live today, because I'm trying to be discreet.
But if I ever see you again, or hear that you have spoken one word of me or my bride-to-be, I will do to you bodily what I have done to your signature. I will place my thumb upon you and press down. I hope I've been clear."
He removed the stained glove, showing the most pristine set of fingers, white as piano keys.
"Take the painting,"
he said to one of his men. The conscript saluted, grasped the painting as if it were a howling infant, and carried it out with arms stretched before him. The Count dropped a felt purse on the painter's table.
"You haven't any sketches of her, have you? No other studies?"
Auger shook his head vigorously.
"If I hear that you do..."
The Count slapped Auger violently across the face with his stained glove.
While Auger still stood with a round expression of shock, the Count dropped the glove at his feet, turned on his heel, and marched from the terrace.
Chapter 13 The trade winds climb the tower along a spiraling, tangled course. Ships do not rise up and down the tower like plums on a line, but rather twist their way up like ivy climbing a tree. Up is not at all a straightforward direction. Every Man's Guide to the Tower of Babel. He had not liked her. He did try to, much as any fair-minded educator worth his salt would try. But she seemed determined to be unlikable, and to repel his weary patience like the mountain peak repels the exhausted mountaineer. He finally gave in to her incline, and let himself roll down the hill of her unlikableness. He inherited her from the retiring headmaster, who looked like the very picture of the old year, departing with a white beard that was as long as a windsock. Senlin, for his part, looked as much like the new year personified as he ever would, cheeks still pink and a little plump, eyes polished almost to tears with optimism for the young minds of tomorrow. Mr. Regimond Desier, wizened headmaster of 53 years and some 1,100 students, bequeathed Senlin the keys to the schoolhouse one sultry summer morning, the inauguration attended only by a pair of clover fat rabbits hiding by the hedge. His thoughts already flying to the grand improvements he would make to this hopelessly antiquated shrine of learning, Senlin expected some final piece of sapient advice from the grey headmaster, who seemed to be still chewing through the residue of his breakfast, though perhaps he was only warming the machinery of his jaw. The CA drew a shuddering breath. Senlin leaned in. The CA said,
"That Maria Bax is a quizzical little turd. Good luck."
Precocious was perhaps a more accurate, and certainly more generous, way of characterizing the young Miss Burks's behavior in class. With chin cupped in her hand and elbow propped upon her desk, she seemed every inch the philosopher, an impression that was only compounded by her limpid eyes and crookedly pursed mouth. But if she was a philosopher, it was only a philosophy of the contrary. She challenged everything he said, his logic, evidence, and authority, with such torturing persistence that Senlin was driven to punishing her on a near-daily basis. First he took away her blotter and inkpot, a privilege of upper classmen, giving her instead the slate and chalk that were the utensils of the novice. Then he assigned her the zinc pail and towel, which must every night skate across the blackboard, squelching all evidence of the day's diagrams. And still she pounded him with insubordinate curiosity. "Mightn't the sun be made out of coal? Is zero really a number, or is it more like an abstract letter? If we don't know who built the Tower of Babel, could it have been built by some other species of animal that has since gone extinct, a species of ingenious beetle, perhaps?" He moved her desk to the front of the class, so that the edge of it touched the front edge of his own. But she was not intimidated by the doubling of his attention, and instead took it as an opportunity to criticize the leggy nature of his chalkboard cursive. He turned her desk toward the wall, but she only raised her voice to interject, which made her echo as if she had the tonsils of a giant. None of it seemed to faze her in the slightest. The only thing that changed from day to day was the color of the ribbon lassoed about her hair,
which was as ruddy as a maple in autumn. Having not yet developed the wiles or elephant skin of a seasoned teacher, Senlin's confidence was sorely tested by her schoolgirl interrogations. As that first year passed, he came to loathe the quizzical redhead because he wondered if she wasn't right to question him. Perhaps he was a fraud, an incompetent dolt, and a polluter of future wits. But then, that first summer came, and a little distance with it. With time to build his kites, and walk the cliffs, and peruse old letters from his beloved professors, he realized the situation was not as insufferable as it seemed. He decided that what Maria Burks lacked was responsibility and difficulty. She was bored. So he decided to find some entertainment for her. When the new school year began, but before she had an opportunity to derail his lesson with some ponderous question that was ultimately unanswerable, at least to her satisfaction, Senlin announced that she, Miss Burks, would be his teaching assistant for the fall, and that, in particular, she would be in charge of the lessons for the children in the lower levels in the subjects of history and writing. She would conduct her lessons in a back corner of the schoolhouse, while Senlin taught the upper levels in the front. Of course, Miss Burks would be responsible for keeping up with her own studies, and there were a half-dozen other caveats besides. But Maria was not perturbed in the least. She leapt at the opportunity. There were false starts and missteps, but soon these were overcome, and Maria was conducting well-organized and well-received lessons on the basics of grammar and the elementary epochs of Ur. Her inquisitions did not immediately or entirely cease, but the more she taught, the more patience she developed with Senlin's lessons. She was more likely to stay after class to pose her questions privately, and her questions were more likely to be deliberate than contrary. He still found her a little egotistical and pestering, but she was, for the first time, tolerable. 3 years later, Senlin was an established headmaster who no longer suffered the howling insecurity of the amateur, and Maria's youthful thorns had been ground down, allowing humour and grace to bloom. Their relationship became cordial, almost collegial. He would be sorry, he had to admit, to see her go. Whenever students departed Esau for a higher institution of learning, it was tradition that the headmaster see them off. Disliking goodbyes, especially public ones, this was not a favourite duty, so Senlin was prone to forget it. On one or two occasions, he had arrived at the train station just in time to watch the great bouquets of steam erupt from the departing train, much to his small guilt and great relief. The day of Maria's departure, Senlin was making an effort to forget the train schedule, and was, even a half hour before her embarking, standing atop a ladder, plucking clods of grass from the gutter of his cottage, sweating in the mid-July swelter, with a handkerchief tied about his head. A spasm of some unfamiliar emotion pulled him off the ladder. He had to see her off. He hadn't time to wash his hands, comb his hair, or change out of his summer breeches and work sleeves. So he looked like a stable boy running down the great green bank toward the town and the station that lay clear across the valley of the inlet. The villagers he tore past could hardly believe it was their headmaster blurring by. He ran like a startled ostrich, and they were convinced, though not surprised, that he had gone mad. In all honesty, Senlin was a little surprised himself. He could not say why he was running, or grinning as he ran. His boot soles skidded when they landed on the weathered boards of the train platform. Recalling the handkerchief tied about his head, he hardly had time to whip it off before he spotted Miss Burks standing beside a steamer trunk, which the local porter was busily weighing and labelling. No ribbon was in her hair today, and her hair stood turned up in a practical bun that made her seem more mature. Her dress was high-collared and long-sleeved, and the skirts hung nearly to the toes of her boots, which were as bright and black as a collie's nose. Since he spotted her first, he got to see her honest state, and she seemed, he thought, sad. When she saw him, shuffling now with handkerchief clutched in hand, her look changed entirely. She smiled warmly and said,
"You are late, headmaster."
"Impossible. Headmasters cannot be late," he said.
The sun must be running fast. This delighted her, and he felt strangely pleased to see it. Soon they both realized that they had been standing there entirely too long, grinning and swaying, and saying nothing else.